Childcare owners, families, business leaders are all excited. They are rightfully saying, how are we going to pay for it? How are we going to sustain it? And I think that we're going to see that return. And so it's not going to be a question of, you know, how can we afford it, but how can we not afford to invest in universal childcare?
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. My kids are all grown up now, but there's so many parts of raising young kids in this country that still feel pretty raw for me. One of the things I remember so clearly is choking over the monthly childcare bill when we had two kids in daycare. We had a brand new mortgage, graduate school debt, medical bills looming, and even then, food costs seemed to be on an unsustainable rise. We made it work. We had two good jobs and money saved. But many Americans are not so lucky. Today, the rising cost of childcare is consistently outpacing overall inflation. An Axios report in 2025 found that the price of daycare rose 29% from 2020 to 2024, with the average cost for two children just over $28,000 a year. That's 35% of the median household income. But it doesn't have to be that way. Other countries around the world have proven that low-cost and even free childcare is possible. Countries like Italy, Germany, Iceland, and Sweden have kept their childcare cost to 5% or less of a family's income. So why can't we? Well, New Mexico is making a big bet on affordable childcare as social infrastructure. It's an expensive venture for the state, but Cabinet Secretary for Early Childhood Education Elizabeth Gorginsky says the returns could cut across the spectrum. Families that can finally invest in their own well-being, thriving children who are ready to enter school, higher workforce participation, specifically by women, and companies who value cost of living for their employees moving to the state. You can bet other cities and states are watching. So please welcome Elizabeth Gorginsky to The Other 80. Well, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you on in this new year.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I'm going to, in our questions, treat the package of policies that started with the establishment of the department. I think the one that's gotten the most attention is the recent decision and amazing policy move to have New Mexico be the first in the nation to provide free universal childcare. So going back to that time when you joined with this vision of really providing social infrastructure through childcare in the state. Out of all of the things that New Mexico could have focused on, every state has a lot of urgent priorities from, in your case, water, as you said just now.
Exactly.
To housing, to climate change. What really drove the decision to make this one of the very top priorities of this administration?
I would have to credit our governor, Michelle Lujan Grisham, for what she called her moonshot for education when she took office on January 2019. And she knew we needed to be bold and innovative to change the trajectory for whole populations of New Mexico children and their families. She immediately worked to improve our K-12 educator salaries. She wanted full-day pre-K, not part-day pre-K. And she wanted to make sure that families had access to what she believed were the important early learning opportunities that would prepare them to enter kindergarten. So right out of the gate, January of 2019, more funding for full-day pre-K for four-year-olds and for three-year-olds, increasing the eligibility limit for families, and again, thinking holistically about a cradle-to-career educational system.
And I think New Mexico is in an interesting position of having been an innovator in early childhood, but also due to a whole combination of factors, falling sometimes last in line when it comes to child welfare and child status.
Exactly.
How did you think about both leaning into that innovation opportunity while also recognizing that you were falling behind? So how did you think about those two almost opposing things in the state?
It was those staggering statistics that were the impetus behind creating the department, to thinking differently about how we intervene and support children in the early years, because what the research has told us, the developmental science, the economic science, the educational outcomes, when children have access to these higher quality learning environments, they're going to do better. We also are a state that has the highest number of children with the highest, what they call adverse early childhood experiences. So there were all these factors that were headwinds against the New Mexico family. And they said, we have to put systems, programs, and services in place that are going to help mitigate, but also really build the resilience across the state. So it was exciting to think, how are we going to do this and how are we going to do it well? Because just delivering programs and services that aren't lifting up the professionals who are delivering the care and aren't giving the programs enough funding to even survive, let alone think creatively and innovate. Those were some of the first tasks that I thought we've got to align. And the governor was smart. Her second year, she said, we need the trust fund. We would go to committee hearings and talk about, oh, wow, in 10 years, maybe we'll have $1 billion in there and the department will get $50 million annually coming off that trust fund. Because again, these are historically, not just in New Mexico, everywhere, underfunded programs. So putting them together under one department, one roof, wasn't going to give us this great boom without additional revenues. And so her wisdom and her insights on that were fantastic. And obviously, it's proved to be one of the best decisions the state probably ever made in terms of an investment that matters and that's going directly into communities to support children's health, development, and education and well-being.
One of the things I loved from you and from the governor were the holistic view about the potential impacts of this policy. Obviously, the first impact is on that child and the ability to provide a safe, nurturing, mind-expanding experience for that child before they start formal school. Also for the family whose pocketbooks have been strained. I remember I was lucky to be able to afford it, but I remember the bill being almost as high as my college bills once my kids went to college. But in addition to that, you've really focused also on the economic impact, both in terms of making New Mexico the most desirable place to have a business and on how those additional dollars in the family's bank accounts can translate into additional opportunities for the family and spending. I'd just love to have you talk a little bit about those triple, quadruple bottom lines that we get from this investment.
That is exactly right. And I mean, when I hear directly from families, which I did last night at a legislative dinner, it speaks so powerfully to your point, to the triple win. She's able to go to work, single mom, three children. She talked about just her own well-being, her own stress level, her ability to be more present and there for her children, to put aside some money for emergencies, to be able to do some of those things that we know that some families in the higher income maybe take for granted. But in New Mexico, our moderate and low income families, I barely have enough to make ends meet right now. And she's so thrilled where her child is, with that nurturing caregiver, the person who's paying attention to her developmental needs and her education and care. We're so excited because we have workforce challenges. The governor has done an incredible job bringing new business to the state. We're very excited about all the economic development opportunities. But the first question that business owner is going to ask is, where can my employees get childcare? So we have an all-in strategy. It's going to take all of us. Our community-based childcare programs have done a fantastic job expanding over the last 5 years, 12% increase in capacity. But we also need our industry leaders to come in and help through that public-private partnership. Because to your point, early childhood childcare programs are buying locally, hiring locally. So that economic multiplier effect that's happening with families not having that huge childcare expense, they're taking those dollars and spending them other places in the economy, and they're feeling that stability and security that allows them to really be there for their child and promote that relational health that we know is critical to long-term outcomes.
You mentioned how uplifting it is to hear from families, both in terms of the impact that you're seeing, but also to learn from them what's important. Yes. And I'd be curious to hear, was there something specific that shifted in the policy or the approach based on things you were hearing from families, whether through surveys or around kitchen table? Was there something that really informed the specific structure of what you're doing?
When we expanded in 2022 to 400% of the federal poverty level, that encompasses about 80% of New Mexico families who have young children who need care. The governor was pushing me much sooner. Why am I tired of these income limits? You know, they're holding us back, you know, because she wants that cradle to career educational system. We have free college, we have this free, you know, pre-K through 12. Let's just get moving here. We said, you know, let's simplify things. Let's just say, you know, we're talking about another 20% of New Mexico families, and we're going to be able to build a much more high quality, robust sector of childcare if we're not spending a lot of time focusing on who's in and who's out and who gets help and who doesn't. You know, the governor was right. He pushed me hard, and our projections are right on track for what we're seeing. And so I think it was a combination of saying, you know, we need more health professionals coming into this state. We know they often are young and starting their family, and they have a lot of student loan debt. They're trying to buy a house and stabilize. They have a mortgage, all these things. And so what could we do that would help the economy, help families, and help children all at the same time?
And I love how that shifts the focus to this being social infrastructure that's needed for a thriving economy and thriving families and thriving communities.
That's right.
Versus as a benefit that is attached to specific people. And the other thing about getting rid of the income limits is it simplifies the administration.
Exactly.
So you're not having tons of staff just in that income verification mode.
That's right.
And I know it's always a challenge too when income's defined differently in different programs and which door do you go in and all of those things. So it just creates a more simple, something like the way we think about K-12 education.
Exactly, like a public good. We were a little bit surprised. 33% of the families who enrolled in November were already eligible at the 400% or less. And so again, is that the stigma? Is it the fact that, you know, we thought we were doing a good job reaching everybody saying, hey, you're eligible if you make this much money. But by saying it's universal, it's just made it like everybody at the dinner last night, the pediatrician who's just moved here from another state, she was thrilled to learn about it. So it was the first time in her life she was going around visiting with childcare programs. But she told her patient about it because her patient came in to the Indian Health Services and she said, what? Because she had just moved here, this mom with, you know, three small children. And so she was a testimonial last night, and that's how compelled she felt by this incredible connection where her pediatrician told her about this public health policy. She's a social worker. We need social workers in this state desperately. And so these are the kind of ways we're thinking about how this important policy is going to help us attract the professionals that we need here in the state to deliver all kinds of services and care for children and families.
Like that focus on nursing, on pediatricians, on social workers, on teachers, all of these.
Exactly.
Even all the civic infrastructure that we need. And, you know, I have attachments and connections to Vermont. And they've tried different things to get
people.
They've
done a great job.
But honestly, this one, I mean, I'll be expecting your marketing campaign for the recent grad.
I need to get the tourism department connected in. But, you know, you exactly. I mean, because when we look at like a firefighter and an educator, you know, they're at the 500-600% of poverty combined, but they need that help. And that's, we've been working, we've got the firefighters and the police. They're trying to attract more women into public safety. And so we're doing work with them. And that's exactly what this is about. It's providing that, I like how you said that social infrastructure that allows children and families to thrive.
So you've mentioned some of the sequential things that have happened. So 2019, your department was established, you as the secretary, and I think you were the first secretary of early childhood amongst the states. 2020, the trust fund was established, which takes revenues and profits from oil and gas and mineral rights, puts it into an established trust fund for early childhood. 2022 expanded to 400% of poverty, which, as you said, covered 80% of the families in the state. So this was a whole package that was pursued, not just in the governor's campaign, but really throughout these last few years of her administration. You know, I think we all can anticipate who the allies would be, from early childhood experts to young families. What were some of the unexpected allies, people that really came in early and supported this? What were the reasons they were at the table?
I would say, I mean, industry leaders have definitely been, whether it's, you know, hospitals or down south where we have a huge oil and gas sector and very little childcare. So that was nice to see them step up. We also saw our school districts, some of them, because they were struggling. So they used some of their COVID relief money to help get their facilities ready to be licensed. And they started offering childcare for their employees. And we're seeing more of that happening as well. We always had the chamber. The chamber was a big support and philanthropy, and that was wonderful. A couple things I want to note that we did here, a huge policy shift that we made was setting our rates for childcare based on a cost alternative methodology. And so that helped educate the whole field about kind of what does it cost to deliver quality care. And our rates at this point have increased almost 100% since the day the governor took office. We have not had too many detractors to, you know, the typical legislators are concerned because we were a new department and we were growing so quickly with millions and millions of dollars. You know, the concern is like, are you going too fast? Is, you know, are things happening too quickly? And I think we've been able to show and demonstrate through our partnerships, through good, being good stewards of the public dollars, that no, we actually can. The majority of this money is going right out into their communities to fund staff. I think families have been, of course, right there with us. Early, when we only raised it to $350 and we didn't eliminate copays for families over $200, it was our eligibility staff who work with us who came to me and said, these families are just, they can't do the copay. They're in tears. They need help. And, you know, we immediately said, we got to respond to this. We had the resources with the COVID relief money. And that was the nice thing. We were able to get a jump start on the governor's vision. In some ways, that was a good thing. And then the trust fund just started growing beyond what anybody had projected. And then the third year, she put her support behind the land grant permanent fund, getting the voters to approve that, which, you know, brought in another $170 million to the agency. So it was all very well, I think in her mind, she saw the vision. She had it. And we just kept executing on that vision.
I saw her speak in the fall, and I remember her also really focusing on women's leadership and women leaders, herself, you, and others in the state. And anyone can be a visionary leader, but I think that understanding and kind of speaking from the perspective of the family is so powerful.
It really is.
All of our experience going through the workforce and what that looks like and what it looks like to be successful both at home and in one's career.
That's right. Yeah, I had a great opportunity to be at a family leadership summit about a month ago, and a woman came up to me and said, you've changed the lives of generations of women.
Wow.
Because just in that notion that there's a choice, that this doesn't have to be the barrier that keeps you from either working to your full employment or to going back to school to pursue a career that you wanted. And you now don't have that barrier of a huge childcare expense.
I grew up in the 60s, and my mom was told by her woman pediatrician that she had to choose being a mom or working. And was smart enough to ignore that and go back to grad school and become a psychologist. But just like how far we've come, but also how much further we have to go, this kind of policy isn't meaningful if there aren't actually spots available for families. And last year, last June, you released a seminal report on the gaps across the state. And as you've pointed out, there has been a growth since 2017 in capacity, but you still have, I think it was 16,000 about, 15,000?
Yeah, 12 to 14. I think we've closed that a little bit since report.
Okay.
But yeah, it is around there, especially for infant and toddler care. Some of that has been definitely through the capital investments that the governor has put across the board in the state, and particularly in our nation's pueblos and tribal communities. So I've just been at two ribbon cuttings in the last month of these gorgeous state-of-the-art early childhood centers at two of our pueblos, and there was a couple last year, and they're fantastic because they have the language immersion and the culture and the traditions are all built into that. One thing we noticed, and we've kind of seen this precipitous decline in what we call registered homes, referred to oftentimes as licensed exempt, so they still have to have all background checks and get child health safety, and but they can only serve up to 4 children in their home. I think New Mexico used to have 2,000 or 3,000 of them. We're now at about 890. And so while our capacity has grown, it's grown in licensed homes and centers. And so we have a campaign to recruit 1,000 registered homes to build back that capacity, which is often what families want. It's oftentimes more culturally grounded in how families want their child cared for. And so that's one strategy we have. And we're working with some of our key statewide partners to do that outreach and to also provide those supports. We also have a low interest revolving loan fund to help our child care programs or people who want to open a child care center get access to capital, very low interest, 2%, and they can get that access to capital. Right now, it has about 12 to 13 million in there. We just closed the application, scored the 116 completed applications, and we'll be working with our partner at the New Mexico Finance Authority to start underwriting those loans to only probably about 12 or 13 programs, but it'll result in about 2,500 more spaces available in the state. 1,000 registered homes will give us another 4,000. And so we've already seen licensure of some new homes and some new centers. I'm talking to providers every day who are like, well, if I get that loan, I will, but I'm going forward anyway. I've got my bank lined up. It's pretty incredible, the capacity of this sector. You know, mostly women, very entrepreneurial, very innovative, the way they see the vision. And I think they've seen where the governor's been heading as we've increased and people have been planning, been purchasing land, they've been looking at buildings. And so we held a childcare summit at the governor's residence a few weeks ago, and we brought in the 5 counties where if we could build a lot more supply, families would be in, children would have more access. And so we brought together county leaders, city leaders, school districts from those parts. And so, you know, as the governor said, we're all leaning in, we're going hard. This is an all-in strategy. The state government, we have our critical role to play, and the department, but so do all these local partners and our private sector. So we're excited. We think big. And so we feel that we'll reach those goals by this time next, you know, in 27, that we'll have achieved those additional 12,000 spaces.
And you mentioned a little bit this move to increase the pay of the childcare workers.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about how you're doing that. Some of the policies include things like incentivizing centers that pay higher,
exactly,
and that are open more, providing scholarships and other kinds of supports directly to those childcare workers. What are your strategies to increase the wages and working conditions of those workers?
Yes, such a great question. When we started in 21, we set the entry-level hourly rate at $12.10 because that was the highest hourly rate in the state at the time. This last time we set it at $18. That's how much we've increased. And it was, you know, it was a little disappointing to see some of the pushback of, you know, we can't, how can we pay people? I'm like, how could you not pay them to come in and do this kind of work at least $21 an hour when you're asking a lot of them to have credentials, you know, observe children, meet with parents, you know, do all these things that are highly relational and very intense. And then I think the other thing we're doing just to generally make people aware of these professions is a Developing Futures campaign through the eyes of New Mexicans, family childcare providers, home visitors, early intervention, center-based pre-K teachers, we tell the story of why you would want to pursue a profession and a career in early childhood. We're moving the profession forward. We've done it, as you pointed out earlier. This was not just like last month or in September, we decided to do all this bold stuff. It's really been part of a system-building movement, working with community, with providers, with professionals, and with families.
So this is the final year of the governor's administration. January 20th, you start a new budget negotiation. She's put forward a budget for the year. And, you know, I think it's not surprising that a policy of like this, like you said before, there are people in the political environment or out in the community that are saying, is this something we can really afford going forward? Yeah. Can we pay for this? It's like, we love the vision, but can we pay for this? So I'd just love to have you talk a little bit about what it's going to take to sustain this financially. There's, I think, $10 billion in the trust fund now. Is that, how far does that take you? And then as you go into this budget negotiation, what are some of the asks? And how do you think about maintaining momentum beyond this administration?
The trust fund right now is at a $500 million annual distribution. The governor has asked for this increase in our budget to come from general fund, not to come from the trust fund, because it'll start eating the corpus of that fund. And we want to see that continue to grow. But that's a decision for the legislature. And they might say, you know what, we want to use the trust fund. And we think that that's appropriate. So those negotiations, as you said, will start on January 20th. What we're doing to support our economy and to support children and families, the early indicators we're seeing are very promising of the investments that the legislature have made in this department and in the system of a universal prenatal to five system. UCLA was, you know, came here. We've done our early development instrument. We're about to do another round of collection. We're seeing 75% of our children are on track developmentally in at least one area of development. We're seeing other promising indicators in our kindergarten reading scores. So I think we want to not shortchange this investment. That was that cradle to career educational system. The promise of this department and the investments in it are about us, about school readiness. It is about improving the overall health, development, education, and well-being of young children. And so I think if we keep our eye on those indicators that are telling us, yes, things are looking different. Families are less stressed. Families are getting connected. They may get connected to childcare and then learn about home visiting. If we believe the Heckman equation, if we believe, you know, the economists coming out of the Federal Reserve say this is your best investment. If it's a 7% return, that's better than anyone's getting on any portfolio. It could be as high as a 13% return. And so it is a bit of a long game, not too long, but I'm hoping we stay the course and that people can see that we're already seeing the benefits of what we've done in the last 6 years. We're seeing huge record numbers of people coming in to get background checks to work in childcare. Like, I think we had 40 the whole month of December last year, and we had 100 in like the first 4 days of December. So there's a hunger, there's an interest in our teacher prep programs. Early childhood is the number one teacher prep professionals are going into. I mean, we've had, it's like a 64% increase in the wages of childcare professionals. Wow. In the last 5 years. And we've seen a 64% growth in the number of early childcare professionals we have, while the rest of the country is about a negative 7%. So, you know, these are the indicators I try to keep putting in front of the legislature to say, this investment that you have made, that we have made together, is working. We can't take the foot off the gas now. It's just exciting to see that childcare owners, families, business leaders are all excited. And I would say the majority of the legislature is too. They are rightfully saying, how are we going to pay for it? How are we going to sustain it? And I think that we're going to see that return. And so it's not going to be a question of, you know, how can we afford it, but how can we not afford to invest in universal childcare?
One of the things I was noticing over the last couple of weeks, we have a new mayor in New York City. What is one of the first platform items that he's been talking about? It's replicating at a city level, but New York is a very big city.
Exactly.
The same kind of approach. And I know other states have also approached you to say, we're really interested. What kind of advice are you giving them about making their own assessment for how they might do this in their city or state?
You know, I do think it's important to bring in the community. And in a sector that is so diverse, so eclectic, so entrepreneurial. You can't afford not to bring them to the table. And I think that has been our success. And quality. You can't give up on the quality and try to just go to scale without those investments in the people delivering the work, delivering that care and education every day to children. And so that does come down to not just your rates, but it is a huge part of it, but other strategies that support infrastructure, whether it's, you know, staffed family childcare networks or community development financial institutions. We brought them together as a whole and said, how can you work together to get more capital into the childcare sector? I think just paying attention to all those levers of your early childhood professional in the classroom or in the home, delivering that care every day. Of course, the children who are the prime beneficiaries and their families, and then the owners and the directors, you know, who have to make it all work. And so each of those constituents become vitally important to your success. And they all have different priorities, but you work with all of them and work to create a childcare sector that is thriving.
I'm going to close out with some questions about just personal reflections for you. It's January. People will be listening a little bit later in the year, but it is the new year. What's something you're curious about as we begin this new year?
What is it like when we actually put our families at the center of our policymaking in this very early period of life, which is not what's the norm in our country? We wait until they're 4 or 5, and then we're good with investing in their well-being and their care. So I'm curious how people will respond and excited to see. I think what I already am seeing is the hopefulness of people here in New Mexico of a brighter future.
And is there a lesson or experience from 2025 that's really sticking with you as you enter this new year?
As we've wound down on 25, we've done this, become a proud partner of Universal Childcare, and people can take the pledge and they can add their personal feelings and thoughts about why Universal Childcare is so important. And so I think what I want to learn from is really reading all of those pledges and digesting what are the key threads that our community is telling us, whether it's a business leader, a childcare provider, or a family, school districts, what are the threads we need to pull through to 26 to say why this policy matters? Why we have 1,000+ people who have said, I'm a proud partner of UCC, and I've been willing to get online and take that pledge and make a statement. I want to make sure we continue to learn from all the voices we heard through our community conversations, through provider roundtables, and not take for granted that, you know, we have to keep learning, listening, and learning from what we're hearing, and then implementing better policies, better practices, so that this universal childcare is a success. We understand that we are on the front lines of a policy. If we don't succeed, this could be a very negative ramifications for our country. And so we have no intention of not succeeding because we have the right mix of political leadership, community level leadership, tribal leadership, and this agency. The staff here are some of the most incredible thinkers, creators, innovators, and hardworking people. So we don't take this responsibility lightly. We know that all eyes are watching. Others know we will succeed. And so it's just keeping our eyes and our ears open and our hearts, of course, to the people who are benefiting so much from this, and then adjusting as what we learn and we hear and we feel becomes much more salient and clear, because this has not been done in this country.
Well, that's a great place to end on this note of incredible hopefulness. The mission you bring and the governor and everyone in the community brings is incredible, but also the flexibility and openness to change and adjusting based on the stories of what matters. So I just want to really thank you for the work you're doing, for being the leaders that we all need for the country. And I hope I'll see many other policymakers put this in their platforms and bring this forward. So thank you for joining.
Thanks, Claudia. I hope so as well.
One of the big themes of The Other 80 is how to make health and support systems more human-centered and simpler. But paradoxically, building simplicity into government programs is really hard. We tend to get caught up in rules and paperwork. We argue over different definitions of family structure or poverty. And we require detailed documentation from families who just need a little help. But New Mexico is showing their commitment to simplicity by offering free childcare to everyone. And I applaud the state and Governor Grisham for their leadership, because a move like this allows them to invest in the system without complexity. But it also means they can focus their energy on outreach instead of parsing eligibility. And I really do hope that other states are watching. The cost of childcare is one place we can make a huge difference for American families to strengthen the social infrastructure everyone needs right now. This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore-Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information on Elizabeth Gorginsky and New Mexico's approach to childcare as social infrastructure. There is more information on my background, the podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time, I'm Claudia Williams.